Welcome to The Wildlife, a program that probes the mysteries of the animal world through interviews with scientists and other wildlife investigators. I'm Laurel Nemi, your host for The Wildlife, and also author of Animal Investigators, How the World's First Wildlife Forensic Lab is Solving Crimes and Saving Endangered Species. Today on The Wildlife, I'll repeat a conversation I had with Tracy O'Toole, the Director of Wildlife Development Programs for Humane Society International. We'll talk about the illegal international pet trade, her job overseeing capacity building programs in Central America for wildlife law enforcement, and also her work helping to establish wildlife rescue centers in Latin America. But first, let me play you today's Creature Call. For this week's Creature Call, we'll travel to Central and South America, that is the natural home of these colorful birds that often end up as treasured pets. Now listen carefully and see if you can guess today's Creature Call. At the end of the show, I'll play these sounds again and tell you what kind of animal made them. Now, let me turn to my conversation on the illegal international pet trade and wildlife rescue centers in Latin America with Tracy O'Toole. Ms. O'Toole currently serves as the Director of Wildlife Development Programs for the International Trade and Development Division of Humane Society International. She oversees programs to build capacity in Central America for enforcement of laws to stop wildlife trafficking, and also for establishment and running of wildlife rescue centers. She also works on public education and outreach programs to combat illegal wildlife trade throughout the region. Before joining the Humane Society, Ms. O'Toole worked extensively in the fields of international development and conservation for various donor organizations, including the U.S. Agency for International Development and Europe Aid. She holds a master's in international business, a BA in international relations, and is fluent in French, Portuguese, and Spanish. When we talked in January 2010, I asked Tracy to tell me about the wildlife trade in Central America and who was doing what.
Well, as you know, strictly because we are talking about the illegal wildlife trade, it's not a real clear-cut process and vision that we have of exactly what's going on a day-by-day basis in the field.
So how do you figure out what's going on and how the Humane Society can address it?
Humane Society International this past year actually conducted an in-depth a wildlife rescue center study throughout five Latin American countries.
What did it involve?
The study involved Guatemala, El Salvador, Honduras, Nicaragua, and Costa Rica. And as part of this study, we at Humane Society International attempted to form a vision of what wildlife traffic looks like within Central America. And one of our tasks was to identify the primary wildlife extraction sites in these five Central American countries, as well as the primary wildlife trafficking routes. There appear to be three primary extraction points.
Where are they?
One was in Honduras in a region called La Mosquitia, also known in English as the Mosquito Coast, which is on the, let me orient myself here, kind of the eastern edge of the country, which borders Nicaragua.
What makes it a key place for extracting wildlife?
That was a primary extraction area because it is an area that is relatively unpopulated with pristine prime forest.
And can you describe some of the other extraction points?
In Nicaragua, we see a high extraction rate in the two autonomous provinces, also located on the eastern edge of the country bordering the Atlantic.
And what about the third major area of extraction?
We also see a high level of wildlife extraction in the Petén region of Guatemala, which is the northeastern corner of Guatemala nestled up against the Mexican border.
And did those have common characteristics as well in terms of either species or the fact that are they all unpopulated with pristine forest?
Yeah, I think the common denominator is because these are rural areas with mostly, you know, heavily forested, non-developed regions, there are a lot of what I'm going to call blind spots in terms of law enforcement because you have, you know, several individuals responsible for a wide area to patrol.
And are there other commonalities between those points of wildlife extraction?
A second one is you're dealing with populations that have relatively few alternatives.
What do you mean? What have they done traditionally to make a living?
Traditionally been involved in the wildlife trade.
And why does it really matter that wildlife is being taken from these areas?
All of these regions have really some of the last real enclaves of very undesirable species, unfortunately, for the pet trade.
Can you give me an example?
In Guatemala, we see some of the remaining stronghold of the scarlet macaw, which is a critically endangered species. And that has been a long-coveted prize for wildlife traffickers, both at the domestic and international level.
Can you give me some other examples?
And then, of course, in both Nicaragua and Honduras, we not only have the red scarlet macaw. In Nicaragua, we have the green macaw, which is highly coveted. We also have a wide variety of parrots in Nicaragua and Honduras.
What's the species that's illegally traded the most?
One of the most trafficked that we see is the yellow-naped parrot, and that one is quite sought after for its ability to talk, and as such, it's highly desired as a pet.
Are there others?
And then, of course, we also have a large variety of primate species, in particularly howler monkeys, spider monkeys, and the white-faced capuchin monkeys. That are also very popular as pets within the region.
And how much do some of these species go for? You know, for instance, how much does a scarlet macaw sell for domestically and or internationally?
Yeah, you know, the numbers would vary significantly. I think that the amount that the poacher would sell it for would be, let's say, several hundred U.S. dollars, let's say maybe like 250 U.S. dollars, but if this animal is destined for the illegal pet trade and on the international level, where the end market would be the U.S. or Europe, that bird could probably go for upwards of $1,000.
It can really add up, can't it?
We're talking about big money for these individuals, where even if we're looking at, let's say, $200 or $300 for a bird, let's take this as a macaw, for example, that is a large sum of money for individuals that are living in rural areas and that do not have a constant source of income. So for them, they see it as a very lucrative trade and a means of sustaining a source of income. And that's one of the real reasons why Humane Society International works at such a community-based level, because we believe the key is, you know, going in and not only do we work with law enforcement individuals, we also try to work with community groups, local NGOs, local cooperatives, in order to educate them not only on wildlife appreciation, but also show them that there are alternatives and more long-term sustainable ways of generating income in and around wildlife without extracting the wildlife itself.
In your opinion, in this region, poverty is really driving the trade?
You know, there's definitely a correlation between the GDP of these countries and the amount of wildlife extraction that we see.
Can you give me an example?
For example, in Nicaragua, which is, I believe, the poorest country, at least in numbers, in Central America, we see a very high incidence of wildlife extraction.
Has this always been the case?
It's been a challenge historically in the region is that in many cases, there exist on the books wildlife protection laws, which effectively enforce CITES, the Convention on the International Trade in Endangered Species, at a local level. However, one of the challenges has been working with governments is that many times government officials are very hesitant to enforce the law because of the extreme poverty of the individuals, meaning that they do not necessarily want to enforce a penalty, whether it be monetary or jail time, due to the impoverished nature of the individuals involved in the trade.
Given that there's this correlation between illegally taking wildlife and poverty, what can you do about it?
I think that there is a direct correlation, and that's why we at Humanitarian International try to incorporate within all of our programs a sustainable and alternative source of income for these individuals. And that's kind of where our ecotourism program has come in historically, is that, you know, we've gone to the communities, we've educated them on wildlife protection, we've educated them on the diminishing population, we've educated them on local laws and the penalties and fines associated with wildlife trafficking. But then we saw the need to kind of go a step further in the sense of offering them ecotourism in some cases as a long-term source of revenue.
Can you give me some examples?
If a poacher goes out to the forest and confiscates 10 parrots, of these 10 parrots, it's likely that maybe one will survive. Those are the odds because they're shipped under horrendous conditions. And we began to teach community members that the same parrot, one parrot alive, is worth 50, 60 years of international tourists coming to the region, bird watchers that are willing to pay for the experience. So really, it's been changing the mentality moving from that to just wildlife is a resource that we can extract and sell and make a quick buck off of, to wildlife is something that we need to protect because it's vital to the long-term economic viability of our community.
And what's been the result?
We're beginning to see that transition in several of the countries, and we continue to work to provide not only to inform and enforce wildlife protection laws, but also to offer an alternative. And this alternative is so important when you're dealing with people, you know, that do have many challenges and very limited opportunities in terms of alternative sources of income.
Could you, I know you've just returned from the region, and I was wondering if you had a story about some of these alternatives, a specific example of what was happening.
Yes. Actually, I'm fresh off the plane from Nicaragua, and during that visit, I was working primarily with a wildlife rescue center in Managua, but I also had the opportunity to visit a local community on the Pacific coast of Nicaragua in an area called Chacocente.
Can you describe the community a little bit?
This is a community that has historically, they're fishermen, and they've historically lived from items coming from the sea.
And what's been their most lucrative source of income?
One of the more lucrative sources of income traditionally for this community has been the sale of sea turtle eggs.
Is that common in Central America?
Within the Central American region, sea turtle eggs are considered a delicacy and are also viewed as a source of almost a sexual aphrodisiac for male potency. It's kind of one of the old wives' tale type traditions that developed.
So what does that mean for this community?
This particular community in Chacocente, you know, for decades and probably even more than that, has lived in some part off of the sale of sea turtle eggs. Now, Humane Society International has been working since 2003, I believe, with a local community cooperative there to try to turn the tide, reduce poaching, and to train community members as local guides.
And has that worked?
So that now we see the community that was once, some members perhaps were involved in poaching, are now the actual enforcers themselves. And they are running a community lodge there with a concession from the Nicaraguan government. And they are beginning to host international tourists that come to do night walks on the beach in order to view the sea turtles.
And what kind of turtles are you talking about?
In this particular case, they're primarily Olive Ridley sea turtles and leatherback turtles.
So they're now making money off this?
The tourists are now paying for the experience to view the turtles. And as such, the community has started to self-police because now the turtles have become a resource for a sustainable source of income through tourism. And individuals are no longer tolerant, or at least moving towards not becoming tolerant, of individuals from poaching the sea turtle eggs.
And how has the government reacted to this?
Another interesting development is the Nicaraguan government is now heavily enforcing the ban on sea turtle eggs. and actively patrols the beach, which I was very happy to see during my trip. We probably had been on the beach all of about 3 to 4 minutes before we were approached actually by a member of the military who was approaching the beach.
What did he do?
And he quickly wanted to ask us a few questions to make sure that we were there as tourists and that we had an appropriate guide and that we were not there to extract eggs. So that's definitely been a success story. And that's just one sample of the many communities that we're working with in the region.
Can you give me another example? You'd also talked about an example of what you're doing with cacao farming in the region, which is both to reduce wildlife extraction, build habitat, and also earn farmers money.
Upon initial thought, one might think that that might not be have much really to do with the Humane Society, but in fact, we work with local small cacao farmers throughout Central America to help them establish biological corridors on their property so that animals can migrate according to their traditional migratory patterns between cacao farms when traditionally that the trees had been cut down and just leveled for farming purposes. We encourage them to replant in order to allow animals to exhibit their natural behavior.
So that really creates habitat. And what kind of species does it involve?
Mostly you're dealing with migratory species of small parrots and also finches that travel from South America up until North America. We're also dealing with a small mammal species. One of the animals that frequents the cacao farm is an animal called a coyote, which is kind of like the Central American version of a raccoon.
Tell me about some of the challenges with that project.
One of our challenges is there's been a traditional conflict between farmers and wildlife.
Why is that?
Wildlife is often enticed to feed on the wonderful and enticing cacao plant itself.
So how do you stop that?
So our initiative in planting the trees in and around the cacao farms is to plant fruit-bearing trees that are a natural alternative source of food for many of the migratory and local bird species in order to try to alleviate the conflict that has developed as a result of wildlife feeding on the cacao plants.
Wow, that's really interesting. I wanted to back up and talk a little bit about what are the local laws and the penalties involved.
Okay, sure. That varies actually pretty substantially by country.
Can you give me some ranges?
The penalties can range all of, between several hundred dollars up until 10 years in prison in the region.
What is the norm?
Usually, the norm seems to be that the poacher could be fined upwards of 1 to 2 months of their salary. So obviously that would vary according to the individual. And also prison time, usually the largest actual sentence that I've seen personally has been 2 years for an individual. And it's actually worth mentioning that these laws in several of the countries regarding fines and prison time associated with wildlife poaching have been on the books for quite some time in some of the countries, but have not been enforced. And it's actually only until recently that these laws have really come into effect and the governments have begun taking them more seriously.
Can you give me an example of how that's played out?
I can give you the example of Nicaragua, for example. Up until approximately 3 months ago, no poachers had been fined or imprisoned in Nicaragua, although the law existed on the books that it was illegal to do so, and the fines and penalties were very, clearly defined within the law. And up until that point, the national police officials would just confiscate the animal and then release the poacher. And what we found is they confiscated the animal, and then the poacher went right back and extracted again, because there was really no way to motivate that individual not to do that because there were no real consequences.
And how has that changed?
I am happy to report during our visit last week, Nicaragua has begun to enforce their wildlife laws. And as such, I believe two individuals to date have actually received 2 years in prison and several fines have been issued. Now, this is interesting because Humane Society International has been working very closely with these governments since pretty much 2003 on helping them and encouraging them to enforce wildlife protection laws. And now, as a result of Nicaragua, because both the military and the national police are very effectively enforcing their laws, we now have a large quantity of animals that are being confiscated and are now being moved to the one and only Wildlife Rescue Center of Nicaragua. So now we find, I guess that's be careful what you wish for mentality, because now we have an overwhelming amount of animals. But the hope is that that will actually subside, that this is a natural increase in animals as the law is enforced, and that as poachers and other individuals involved in wildlife trafficking see that the government does in fact mean business and they are going to confiscate, there will be solid consequences for participating in the illegal wildlife trade, that the numbers of confiscations will diminish as individuals realize it's just not worth it for me anymore and seek to pursue other alternatives of income. So this is kind of a natural rise that we see in confiscations.
Why has the government started enforcing the law?
Well, it's very interesting. The U.S. government, I'm sure as many of your listeners know, has a free trade agreement with five Central American countries and the Dominican Republic, which is called the Free Trade Agreement of CAFTA-DR.
What are the provisions of this agreement?
Part of this agreement, the U.S. government has asked the five Central American governments as well as the Dominican Republic to come into compliance with the CITES Convention.
And what does that mean in practice?
And as such, the U.S. State Department has made it a priority of such, among other priorities, with the Central American and Dominican governments to help them more effectively enforce their national legislation related to CITES. And actually, most of Humane Society International's work in combating the illegal wildlife trade within Central America over the last several years has been able to occur in part thanks to a grant from the U.S. State Department. So really, it's interesting to see that, you know, the diplomacy and the international grant funding from the U.S. government has started to really have an effect on the ground in terms of helping these countries come into compliance with CITES and environmental protection law.
Because many of my listeners won't know about what CITES is.
Uh-huh.
Just have you do the quick and dirty CITES in a minute.
Sure. The CITES is the Convention on International Trade in Endangered Species of Fauna and Flora, and it came into effect in 1975.
And there are 175 countries that have become a party to that convention.
The U.S., as well as all Central American countries, are signatories to this convention. And as such, they are tasked with implementing certain national laws in order to enforce the treaty.
And what does that mean in practice?
Now, what does CITES do? CITES lists, the idea is for CITES is to, it's not eliminate trade, but rather to regulate it in a sustainable way. So CITES has animals and plants divided into three appendices.
Can you describe those appendices?
Appendix 1 are those animals that are critically endangered for which trade is strictly prohibited except for scientific purposes. Appendix 2, trade is permitted but is closely monitored. And Appendix 3 is actually for countries to list animals at a national level that they believe could potentially become endangered or threatened if their particular population of that animal is not closely monitored.
So how is the treaty implemented?
As part of the implementation of this treaty, each government has what we call a management authority.
What does the management authority do?
The management authority in each country is responsible for issuing permits, which allow an animal that is listed as a CITES species to enter or exit the country.
Can you give me an example of that?
For example, if a zoo in Houston were to attempt to do an interchange of animals, let's say wild boars, for example, with a zoo in Nicaragua, the CITES Management Authority, both in the U.S. and in Nicaragua, would have to approve the transaction.
And who is the management authority?
In the U.S., the CITES Management Authority is actually the Fish and Wildlife Service, which is a division of the Department of Interior. And that's kind of how CITES works.
Okay.
That's CITES in a nutshell.
Yeah, no, I appreciate that.
Now, the next meeting of CITES will be in March 2010. Has the Humane Society been working on some issues for that meeting?
We've actually been working extensively to uplift red-eyed tree frogs to CITES because, as I'm not sure if your listeners know, many of the amphibian populations throughout Central America and South America have been affected by a fungus in recent years, which has decimated local populations. As such, we're working with the governments of Guatemala and Mexico are actually proposing to include the red-eyed tree frog as an animal protected under CITES. So that will be something that Humane Society International will be working and lobbying very hard for in the coming months.
And how does that process work?
My understanding is basically a government has to sponsor an initiative. For example, the governments of Mexico and Guatemala have decided to sponsor the red-eyed tree frogs. I know the U.S. government is attempting to, they're sponsoring the uplifting of the polar bear, I believe, from CITES Appendix 2 to CITES Appendix 1. And then the governments convene in Doha in next spring, and they then vote. And there's a whole lobbying process and exchange of information that goes on between the different government representatives and the NGO community. And basically, you know, it's a very democratic and collaborative process, and each individual country is able to vote on the species as to whether or not they believe they should be uplisted or delisted or included in CITES. So it's actually a very interesting United Nations type experience, all for the benefit of wildlife conservation and regulating trade. So it will definitely be something interesting to follow, and I think probably interesting for your readers that might not know about this. But this is a very dynamic process that does go on.
I'm talking with Tracy O'Toole, Director of Wildlife Development Programs for the Humane Society International. For the rest of the program, I wanted to go back and talk a little bit about the wildlife rescue centers. And you had mentioned earlier that as a result of increased law enforcement, there's actually now an issue of confiscated animals and what to do with them.
The wildlife rescue center component is essential to Humane Society International's work in Central America because we have been tasked through our grant with the State Department and traditionally as an organization with, you know, working with wildlife enforcement officials, customs, national police, Department of Justice in these countries to help them learn what CITES is and how to enforce it. And also working with the public to quell the demand for illegal wildlife and to discourage extraction. But at the end of the day, when, as we've seen in the case of Nicaragua, when one begins to effectively enforce national CITES laws, confiscations rise.
So success really breeds its own problems as well.
Of course, when you're dealing with live animals, CITES requires that governments maintain at least one wildlife rescue center per country in order to receive, treat, attempt to rehabilitate, and whenever possible, release wildlife back into the native environment. And with Central America in particular, many of the species that are confiscated are critically endangered or threatened.
That really makes wildlife rescue centers critically important.
The role of a wildlife rescue center is so essential because really, without a wildlife rescue center, the alternative for confiscated wildlife is pretty much a life in captivity, either at a zoo or at a private residence. So for us, the goal is to intake these animals, to treat them, and to try to get them back into the wild to reinforce native populations that have been very hard hit by the illegal wildlife trade.
Can you tell me a little bit about what the Humane Society has been doing with regard to the wildlife rescue centers?
Humane Society has worked in 5 Central American countries extensively with wildlife rescue centers.
So what have you been doing and how have you been doing it?
And our work has pretty much been a three-pronged approach. We have helped build infrastructure at the wildlife rescue centers through small grants. Our work has helped build quarantine facilities, laboratories, clinics, cages, enclosures, bird flight cages, things of that nature.
And what's the second prong?
We also help wildlife rescue centers develop protocols for the proper intake, treatment, and handling of animals, as well as the proper rehabilitation and release of animals.
And what is the third prong?
And then finally, we also offer an extensive training program, and we're working with wildlife rescue centers in the region to develop a network so that they can share ideas and protocols and kind of lessons learned. And actually, this year, starting in November of 2009, we're embarking on a very exciting project where we are developing what we're calling 4 model rescue centers in the Central American region. And Humane Society International has been collaborating very closely with a nonprofit organization based here in the UK called the Global Federation for Animal Sanctuaries. And this Global Federation for Animal Sanctuaries is the first nonprofit of its kind to establish international gold standards in the treatment of animals at sanctuaries. Now, of course, a wildlife rescue center is not the same as a sanctuary, because a sanctuary, their end goal is for an animal to live out their natural life in the best way possible, and often sanctuaries are dealing primarily with exotic species.
And what's the goal for wildlife rescue centers?
The wildlife rescue center, in contrast, the goal is not for the wildlife to live out their natural lives in captivity, but rather to return them to the forest and to their natural habitat as quickly and as professionally and safely as possible.
So what does that mean for Humane Society's programs?
So over the next 18 months, Humane Society will be partnering with 4 wildlife rescue centers in Central America.
Can you tell me more about them?
We'll be working with a wildlife rescue center in Petén in the northeastern corner of Guatemala. We'll be working with the Wildlife Rescue Center in El Salvador near the Honduran border. We'll be working with the Wildlife Rescue Center in the heart of Managua, Nicaragua, and also with another Wildlife Rescue Center in San Jose, Costa Rica.
And what will you be doing?
And the idea is our work will involve infrastructure, protocol, and training support in order to bring up these rescue centers to international gold standards in the region.
And what are those gold standards and protocols? Can you describe them a little bit?
Yes,
a
wide variety of protocols. For example, animal intake, animal reception. Each rescue center has to have a very strict criteria and protocol under which they accept animals.
Can you describe that in more detail?
For example, many of the wildlife rescue centers are not able to accept animals that have lived an extended period of time in captivity.
Why is that?
This is because the Wildlife Rescue Center is focused on animals that are viable for rehabilitation and release. And as such, animals that have lived many years in captivity are no longer, unfortunately, able to look for food themselves and also to bond with other animals.
Can you give me an example with a specific species?
For example, with spider monkeys that are unfortunately very popular as pets throughout Central America, Once spider monkey has lived in captivity for a long period of time, they do imprint on humans, meaning that they no longer really associate themselves with other spider monkeys and can also become aggressive towards other monkeys and are not able to be released back into the wild. So we work with rescue centers to really focus on, you know, what are their key species and which animals should be taken into the center and which ones should not. We also work with them to develop very strict quarantine protocol.
Why do quarantine protocols matter so much?
It's very important because when wildlife is received from poachers, the origin of the wildlife and the conditions of the wildlife, the origins can be unknown and the conditions can be quite horrendous. And the last thing that we want wildlife rescue centers to do is to introduce contagious diseases into the general population of the rescue center or to pose a threat to the health of staff, volunteers in the center, or the local community. So we work with them very closely to develop a biohazard containment and very strict protocols in and around the clinic and quarantine area.
So how long might an animal be quarantined?
So the animals undergo 30 to 40 or more days depending on the species.
Are there other types of protocols that are important for wildlife rescue centers?
And we also work very closely with them on protocols for rehabilitation, which are species specific, and also protocols for release. Because in our initial work within the region, one of the problems that we saw is that a lot of work was being invested at the rescue center to rehabilitate animals, and then these animals were just kind of, they were being driven to a forest and just released without any previous study in the forest area to see if it was a viable ecosystem for that particular species. And unfortunately, the animals died soon after because they were not able to find traditional sources of food for themselves.
So how have you changed that?
So we work in coalition with local universities as well as rescue centers to help them develop a very strict rehabilitation, release, and post-release monitoring protocols in order to ensure that the animals that have gone through the center have the highest chance of survival in the wild as possible.
And can you take me through, we've done this a little bit because you've talked a little bit about, okay, an animal comes to the center. And so what happens? You talked a little bit about the intake and then the quarantine.
Mm-hmm.
But if you were an employee there, what would be your daily life?
Yes. Let's see. An employee at a rescue center, most of it is very hands-on, down and dirty work, you know, cleaning of cages and things of that nature. But kind of to walk you through the process of an animal, let's say we have a yellow-naped parrot, for example, which is an animal that we see very frequently at the rescue centers. They would be taken in, and usually these are confiscated in large quantities. They would come into the animal reception area. They would immediately have a file opened for those particular species or group of species. And this file would involve their diet, the conditions under which they need to be maintained, etc. Then the animal would undergo a veterinary examination in order to check for initial signs of disease or animal suffering. In the case of extreme suffering, we encourage rescue centers to euthanize the animals. And then the animals, following the initial evaluation, if all checks out, they're not exhibiting any signs of outward disease, they would be moved to the quarantine area.
And if they do have signs of disease?
If they are exhibiting any types of outward disease, they would be moved to an isolation area, which is separate from the quarantine zone, in order to prevent the disease or bacteria, whatever it may be, from entering the general population. The birds would then undergo approximately 30-35 days of quarantine in the isolation area there.
Then what happens?
At that time, they would begin to be rehabilitated in terms of nutritionally. They would also be treated for any kind of mites. Glue would be removed from their feathers. Upon successful completion of the quarantine period, they would be moved to rehabilitation enclosure. After a period of time there, they would be moved to what we call bird flight cages.
What are these bird flight cages?
And this is really important because many of the rescue centers traditionally had just been moving animals from quarantine into small cages and then releasing them. But this does not involve animals that have gone through a very traumatic experience because, as we all know, poachers are not very careful. And many times they drug or anesthetize the animals. The animals can be severely injured, have problems with their wings, etc. So it's very important that they then pass through a rehabilitation pre-release phase.
What does that mean?
With parrots, that would be a flight cage. And the flight cage is going to allow the parrots to begin to maneuver as they would in the wild, fly up and down from branches, begin to feed themselves from traditional fruit-bearing trees in the area. And this part of rehabilitation is so important because this takes place in isolation or relative complete isolation from humans. This is when we start to really limit the amount of interaction that staff at the Wildlife Rescue Center or that volunteers would have with the wildlife.
Why is that important?
Because, the goal is not to make these animals pets, but rather to make them, to keep them wild. So these flight cages are located in very heavily forested areas where the animal can then kind of make that transition back into the wild. And then, of course, upon successful rehabilitation, they could potentially be ready for release back to enforced native populations.
And how big are these flight cages?
The one that I just, it varies by species. Raptors, owls, hawks, things of that nature, they need a larger enclosure. I just visited a flight cage in Nicaragua, and I'd say that it's actually built in an L shape in order to allow the birds to have to turn and maneuver as they would out in the wild, so they're not just flying back and forth in a straight line, but rather they're turning and flying up and down. I'd say it's probably approximately 25 feet long in the primary shape of the L, and then on the lower part of the L, maybe another 18 feet or so. And at least probably a good 20 feet high as well. I mean, it's a very, very large enclosure.
What do they look like inside?
We actually strategically place branches, and they plant trees within the enclosure that encourage the birds to behave as naturally as possible in terms of, flying from, a low position to a high position, et cetera. And then also we encourage them to plant native trees in and around these enclosures so that the birds will feed themselves, which is our end goal after all.
And you talked a lot about rehabilitation. And I guess what is the rehabilitation process for a captured or poached bird?
I think in the case of birds as well as all wildlife there at the center, there are two main phases, the physical and the psychological. Oftentimes people focus strictly on the physical at rescue centers. For example, the bird has, feathers missing, the wing is slightly broken, we need to rehabilitate the wing, and as soon as he's ready to fly, we need to release them. But the rehabilitation process, while the physical is such an essential part of that, and that's why we have these flight cages in terms of, encouraging them to strengthen their muscle potential and build endurance. We also need to take into account the psychological rehabilitation, not only with birds, but also with primates, which are particularly sensitive to stress. And that's why these enclosures, which are kind of the pre-release phase, if you will, are isolated from humans as much as possible, because these animals need to begin to form groups with their own species and need to begin to, behave naturally and look for traditional sources of food and water for themselves and begin to reintroduce themselves back into their behavior before the poaching occurred. And that's why, and this is part of the psychological rehabilitation process, And birds, just you know, the entire physical and psychological process could last upwards of a year in some cases with extreme injury. And what we see monkeys, for example, the howler monkey is particularly susceptible to stress, and the psychological component of rehabilitation is much longer.
So what do monkeys need to be viable for release?
Monkeys, in order to be viable for release, we work with them in order to form their own groups prior to release, because it's not viable to release a monkey on its own. So part of the rehabilitation process is to allow the monkeys to form social groups with other confiscated monkeys of the same species. And at one of our wildlife centers in ARCAS, they've been working extensively with monkey species in order for them to form their own groups prior to release back into the wild. So that kind of gives you a little taste of both the physical from a veterinarian medical perspective and also the psychological for the long-term well-being and viability of the animal.
And what about the release aspect? You've talked a little bit about the forming of groups, and when is a bird or a primate ready to be released, and how is that determined, and then how do they actually go about releasing the animals?
Well, you know, it obviously varies by species, and it's left to the discretion of the head veterinarian at all of the wildlife rescue centers. But for example, with a parrot, when a parrot is able to fly, maneuver, socialize, and feed itself within the pre-release enclosure, and it has been in the actual enclosure for months, and so that it has completely disassimilated to interaction with humans, that's at a point where the vet would want to go and look and assess whether or not the animal is ready for release. And not only does the animal have to be ready for release, but there has to be a site within its natural ecosystem that can sustain the animal. It's very futile to just rehabilitate the animal and then release them right back into an area where poachers are, and they will, you know, immediately extract them again. So one of the areas that we've been working very recently and will continue to do with the wildlife rescue centers in Central America is selecting release sites.
And is that easy or difficult?
This has been challenging, as traditionally the mentality has been just kind of, oh, it's wonderful to release animals, let's release them wherever and wherever we can. Unfortunately, that doesn't lead to long-term longevity of the animals. And one of an innovative solution that has come up in recent years is that we actually, particularly in Nicaragua, where I just came from, I might want to mention this, they're working now to improve their release protocols, which traditionally have been poor. And in doing so, they're working with local communities. And these local communities are serving as almost park ranger type individuals, and the communities are self-policing the nature preserve area, because again, they see wildlife as a source of income for themselves. So that has been a very innovative approach. With monkeys, for example, the process is much more in depth, but I can tell you, for example, with our wildlife rescue center that we're working with in Guatemala, they have spent a good year and a half or more working with howler monkey species and informing their own small group.
And how's that going?
They're now, you know, self-feeding. They're bonding with members of their own species, and they're now starting to return calls of howler monkeys that they hear in the wild in and around the rescue center. So that's been a great sign that they're moving towards release, although we haven't been able to release them. And with primates, it's particularly very, very difficult. And that's why it's so important that governments, rescue centers, and universities all work together, because I think we all have a piece of this puzzle.
And how are you ensuring that that happens?
We're encouraging the wildlife rescue centers in Central America to form alliances with biology students and conservation students and ecology students within the region, so that these students that are working to do ecosystem studies as part of their thesis, et cetera, that this information can benefit the rescue centers in terms of viable sites for release, and that also that university students can get involved in post-release monitoring of species to find out what is the, you know, 2-year, 4-year, 6-year prognosis of these animals once they are back in the wild.
And has there been enough time for the post release monitoring? And have you had any results yet?
It's rather new in terms of the post release monitoring, but they have begun several of the rescue centers. They regularly band, particularly the birds. They put little metal rings around their feet, and the rangers in and around the protected areas have begun to monitor some of the birds, and we've seen that those birds produce more birds. And these are particularly small green parakeet type birds, but it shows that there is some success. But I think that's the challenge in the next year, 2 years in the region is really, you know, we're moving these rescue centers to be, you know, the gold standard per se in model rescue centers. But the release protocol is the challenge.
Is that specific to Latin America?
That's not only in Latin America, but throughout the world, is that the release and post-release monitoring is the tricky part. And that's why it's important to involve both the government and the universities in the process. So hopefully you and I can have this conversation in a year or two from now, and we can have some fabulous results for you.
I look forward to that. And I just wanted to close by asking a couple of questions about, can people visit the facilities, and also, what could people do to help?
Yes, actually, thank you. That's a wonderful question. A key component of some of the wildlife rescue centers that we work with is a volunteer program. In particular, I'd like to highlight the program that we work with in ARCAS, that's ARCAS, Petén, Guatemala. And that wildlife rescue center is very successful and financially sustainable due in large part to volunteers that come both from the national level and international level. We have many Americans and Europeans that come down there, and it's a volunteer vacation. And if anyone's interested, they can learn more by typing in ARCAS Guatemala, and if they want a hands-on experience, they can go down there and work with a wide variety of native birds and monkeys and mammals from Central America, and I promise you it will be the experience of a lifetime. And also, here in the U.S., you know, if you're at a pet store and you see exotic, very enticing birds and maybe you'd like to make a purchase, ask some questions about perhaps what the store's policy is for acquisition of these animals, and maybe do a little bit of investigative work as to where these birds come from. Just to make stores and individuals in the U.S. also more accountable and make sure that these birds are, in fact, raised in captivity. And if you'd like more information in general on the program, you can visit us at www.hsi.org.
Fantastic. Thank you so much. I appreciate it.
Oh, thank you for the opportunity.
I hope you enjoyed that conversation about wildlife rescue centers and the illegal pet trade in Central America with Tracy O'Toole, Director of Wildlife Development Programs for the Humane Society International. Now, let me play you today's creature call once again and see if you've guessed it correctly. This colorful bird lives in Central and South America and often ends up in the illegal pet trade. This bird was also one of the ones mentioned in this program. Do you have an idea yet? It's a yellow-naped parrot, also known as a yellow-naped Amazon parrot, which is considered to be a subspecies of the yellow-crowned parrot. In their natural habitat of the Pacific slope of Central America, in southern Mexico and northwestern Costa Rica, yellow-naped parrots are endangered, largely due to both deforestation and illegal removal of young for the pet trade. These bright green birds stand about a foot high and have flashes of yellow feathers on their foreheads and at the back of their necks. Yellow-napes are loved as pets because of their intelligence, clownish personalities, and impressive talking and singing abilities. They also have a great sense of pitch so that when they talk, they sound amazingly like humans. Now listen and imagine you're in a humid tropical rainforest. Archived episodes of The Wildlife are available on iTunes, at my website, laurelnemi.com, and at laurelnemi.podbean.com. You can stream the wildlife live at theradiator.org every Monday from 1 to 2 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. And, of course, if you have comments about this show or ideas for future ones, you can email me at laurel@laurelnini.com. The Wildlife is generously underwritten by the Lake Champlain Land Trust, a nonprofit organization permanently conserving the lands, lakeshore, critical wildlife habitats, and natural areas of Lake Champlain. More information is available online at lclt.org. This has been The Wildlife. I'm your host, Laurel Nimi, and you're listening to The Radiator, 105.9 FM, WOMM LP, in Burlington, Vermont.